Hi everybody, we are recording today's episode of Adapting on May 13, 2022, and I am pleased to have with me today two of this year's award winners of the Jewish Education Project's 2022 Robert M. Sherman Young Pioneers Award. It's a really interesting conversation, and I'm hesitant to say with two up-and-coming educators, because these two educators are fantastic in their own right today, and for sure tomorrow as well. This is part of a two-part series where next week we're going to feature the other three award winners, but what's really important for everybody to listen to here, because I know all of you listening care about Jewish education, is the non-linear trajectory which these two amazing professionals have taken to get to where they are today. And I think it's precisely because of that non-linear direction that they are able to have the most incredible impacts that they are having. So it's a really interesting conversation with two voices that you don't normally get to hear from in Jewish education, but stay tuned because this is just part of the ongoing work we're doing to highlight innovative and exciting practices in Jewish education today.
This is Adapting, the Future of Jewish Education, a podcast from the Jewish Education Project, where we explore the big questions, challenges, and successes that define Jewish education. I'm David Breifman.
Hi, everybody. Today is a really special day for me on this episode of Adapting, and I am so excited and thrilled to be speaking with Francie Goldberg and Emily Hausman, two of the five recipients of the Jewish Education Project's 2022 Robert M. Sherman Young Pioneers Award. The Young Pioneers Award recognizes innovative education in the greater New York City area, just like the work that Francie and Emily have done, and both of them have demonstrated a personal and professional commitment to new ideas that have made significant impact on the communities in which they serve. Francie, as you will soon hear, is a director of admissions and marketing, as well as the library at Hank Plainview, soon to be known as the Merkaz Academy, and Emily is the director of early childhood education at Riverdale Y, a JCC in the Riverdale neighborhood of the Bronx. So two educators from different backgrounds in different settings, but I'm sure we'll come together in a really great conversation about not just the future of Jewish education, but about what's really taking place today. So welcome, first of all, to Francie and Emily.
Thank you so much for having me.
David, thank you for having us.
Great. So it's good to have you both here. Start by telling the audience a bit about what drew you into the work that you're currently doing. So let's start off with Francie. Tell us a bit about yourself.
So I started in marketing. I got a master's in library science. I worked in a public library. And when I moved to Long Island, I ended up taking a job at the local Jewish day school where my children go. And I have two jobs there. I'm the school librarian and I am their director of admissions and marketing.
So we're going to explore what it's like to be what would seemingly be two very different jobs and how they may or may not intersect, admissions and librarian, but we'll get back to that in a second. So Emily, please introduce yourself to our audience.
I've always been a kid person. I've always been a little kid person. I went to Jewish summer camp and I always had the youngest bunk for years at camp. So then when I went to college, I did a combined BA MA and I was always drawn to the youngest group, to the youngest class. I started Tat Shabbat and youth groups at this independent minyan in LA. And they always, in graduate school, they kept trying to pull me older to older kids. And I kept saying, no, this is where it's at. So it's just always been who I am.
Okay, so I'm not going to try and pull threads between the two of you when they're not necessarily there, but I do want to explore this notion of the schooling that you both went to in order to get to where you are today, because I think the role of education or educators is often we don't talk about it, but both of you took paths which could have taken you in multiple different directions in your careers, but let's explore the graduate degrees that you both pursued in order to get to where you are today. So Emily, talk to us a bit about the work that you did at university level.
So I have an MAED, a Master's of Arts in Jewish Education from the American Jewish University in Los Angeles. And what's interesting or funny to me now is that I'm the only one from my cohort who went into early childhood education. And now their graduate school is offering both BAs and MAs in early childhood education, something that I did 12 years ago.
And why do you think that's the case? Is there a resurgence in a need or a renewed interest in early childhood education?
I think people are finally recognizing that the field of early childhood education is deeply education as well. We try not to use the word preschool because this is school and it's just as much school as high school and just as much school as middle school. And I think our field across the nation is finally taking recognition of that.
So I just want to ask you this question. We've had some guests before talking specifically about early childhood education, but these kids are young. So when you talk about education for these kids, like, what are you really talking about?
We are talking about the very foundation for our community, our youngest citizens, the people who are going to one day grow up to lead it. And how do we ensure that our future is bright? We start at the foundation, and everything we teach them can, if done in the right way and scaffolded and structured, they can learn and explore with us.
And Francie, a librarian as an educator. These things, like, are not necessarily one and the same thing, but talk a bit about your graduate experience, your university experience, and how that's led you to where you are today.
Well, my undergrad degree, I did go to business school. I have a degree in marketing. I never thought I would end up in Jewish education. Originally, I got a master's in library science because I love pop culture. I love working with kids, but then only for short periods, and then they go home to their parents. So being in the library setting really merged a lot of my favorite things. And similarly to Emily, they actually now have a school media specialist track in library school, which did not exist until I had graduated. So for the school librarians that are in elementary, middle, and high schools, there actually is a track for that now, which was just emerging as I was graduating. And in my school, I do teach library classes to the nursery as well. So that's 3 and 4-year-olds, because that is how we overlap. I do touch upon those youngest students as well.
So I don't mean this as a disparaging comment necessarily, but libraries have a certain reputation in society today. And I've got a feeling that both of you would think that you're, in some ways, you're both trailblazers, like the work that you were doing then has now become more mainstream. But I want to hear a bit about the evolution of libraries. And is the library today that you're working in the school, is it the same as what you imagined you'd be going into when you first started off in this area of study?
So as long as children need to read, I think that there will always be physical books for children. That is my first thought. It's definitely evolved. When I first started, I had very little to no technology. Now my older students, my 4th, 5th, and 6th graders, have a major technology component to their research. They are learning how to fact check Wikipedia entries and spot fake news. They are learning how to research and put in-text citations in reports. It's very different using the internet than it is using a physical encyclopedia. It's funny to show them a physical map when I teach them how to create routes on Google Maps. So it's definitely evolved, but in really great ways.
So when people come into your library in the school, is the first thing you ask them to do is to be quiet, I imagine, right?
Never. I have dynamic shelving, which means that the books face forward. They're not reading spines anymore. It's very self-directed and independent. And as long as I can get those instructions out, they are free to talk to each other.
So we are going to talk a bit about the work that you're doing in the present, but I am interested in some of your own like biographies that got you to where you are. So Emily, talk to us a bit about camp, your involvement growing up in these settings and what it meant for you to first get involved with education and how that led to your trajectory being such a great early childhood educator today.
So for me, I grew up in New York. We have this like phrase, out of towners. I grew up in the Lehigh Valley area of Pennsylvania, in a much smaller Jewish community. So camp was a very big part for me and a very formative experience. I also spent a gap year in Israel, which really changed my trajectory. I met my now husband there. He was also on a gap year. And that's when I went into the combined BA MA program at the American Jewish University. But all throughout that, early childhood was part of where I was drawn and like part of what I kept circling back to. So to combine that with this Jewish community was important.
Talk to us a bit about this notion of Jewish community. There's an often, I think, the worst kept secret of early childhood education is that it's not just about the kids, but sometimes it's even more about the families around those kids. So talk to me about the types of communities you're trying to create and engage in your work today.
Right. So in a diverse Jewish world, in a liberal Jewish community, early childhood often becomes people's launching point or the place where they start their family's Jewish community, because maybe they go off to college and then they leave their hometowns and they don't necessarily have a reason in liberal Jewish communities to circle back to things we offer. And then when they have kids, there is this sudden spark to think about what kind of family are we going to have and what kind of family are we going to raise and where are we going to plant our roots? And that's where we come in. And what's really amazing is that I have kids come here who had plans. Maybe when you ask them about their schools, they thought, we'll go to the local public school or we'll think about it then. And through us and really doing great work on what we call like an exit process of finding what their next steps are, we're able to connect them to really what makes sense for their family, whether it's a Jewish day school here, a community school, or an affiliated one, or a movement affiliated one, or we've connected families to synagogues and supplementary school programs. We have a lot of interfaith families. And when they come here and we do Shabbat with them and the holidays just become part of life, they are inspired or sparked to go down this road that, you know what, this actually has really great roots and a really great place for our family.
I think this concept of education as a key cornerstone of community building is really important. I think here, Francie, the intersection of your work, both as a librarian, but also involved with the admissions of your school, really comes together quite nicely. So talk to us a bit about what it means to be a community educator in the school and in the role that you're taking part in your environment.
So we are a very small community school. The school is in Plainview. Our parent body is from a 15-mile radius of Plainview. It's one class per grade, nursery through sixth grade. We are a community within this community, and we work really hard to make everyone feel like family from the first day. If you have a baby, we have onesies. And we have big sibling t-shirts for those big siblings in the nursery and kindergarten. We sing happy birthday in a circle to anyone in the school when it's their birthday to start their day. For Grandparents' Day, we make sure to have Sephardi and Ashkenazi foods and tunes that we sing for songs to make sure everyone is comfortable, because we have a lot of Sephardi families in our school. There's a Sephardic synagogue here in Plainview, and there's a very large contingent of Sephardi families from Roslyn who come to our school. We like to make sure that they feel at home and comfortable. So we'll have their rosewater ices served at Grandparents' Day. And we've made intergenerational cookbooks, making sure that everybody's backgrounds are expressed in these recipes. So we're very family-oriented, keeping traditions alive.
So for better or for worse, I think the areas of work that you're involved with have both received headlines in the news in recent times, some locally and some nationally. And I'm interested to explore with you both some of these broader issues that your sector is facing. So Emily, your school is part of New York City's Universal Early Childhood Program, which means that your school is actually open to everyone. So I want you to tell us what that actually means and what it means for a Jewish school or a school within a Jewish community center to be part of the Universal Early Childhood Program.
So this means that my school is essentially a public school program. The only requirement to attend is that you live within the five boroughs of New York City. New York City delivers free threes and fours program through a system called mixed delivery, which means that they are using the infrastructure that existed before they were offering free threes and fours to support and kind of start off the program, which means you will find universal threes and fours programs in community centers, in churches, in synagogues, even in Jewish day schools and yeshivas here in Brooklyn and Staten Island. And what happens is that our families don't pay tuition because it's a publicly funded program, and our teachers are compensated on par with their public school counterparts. And this, with the current legislation that's being talked about and being advocated for, is something hopefully the rest of the nation will join us in.
So I now need to get like specifics in terms of the Jewish education piece of this. So how do you offer a Jewish education in this framework? And I think that's juxtaposed with, and how do you maintain a separation of church and state in a government-funded system?
This is a really great question, and it's one I think about every day with my team of educators and all kinds of people that are joining me in this conversation. Because we accept government funding, the separation of church and state adds a few twists to how we educate. So we don't teach religion, religious practice, or discuss holy figures like deities. What we do is we dig deep into values that are universal. We create a culture that's responsive and sensitive to our community. And we look at big ideas about the holidays and what this looks like in practice. I always think Sukkot is a really good example. It's at the beginning of the year. This year, it happened to be at the very, very beginning of the year. So we spoke about creating a structure with open walls so that everybody was welcome into it, and how we created a space so that people could see what we were doing inside and felt welcome. And also we then decorated that space so that it became our own, and it also glorified the space. All of those are values of Sukkot that are universal values. And then what was even better about it, because we are in a community center and we have overlapping parts all the time, is our local officials offered flu shots for our seniors. And we said to them, why don't you do it in our sukkah? And they came and they did that. And we were able to see our children, our students were able to see that we were caring for our community in this space with open walls that we built.
So I don't want to let this part of the conversation go, because I imagine for many of our listeners, they're going to be asking the question, hang on a second, Emily just redefined what it means to be Jewish in the 21st century. And I think what Emily's really expressing is something which I'd like us all to consider, and something that Adapting the series has tried to review many times, is that the changing nature of what it means to be Jewish is self-evident if you follow some of the sociological trends in the Jewish people. And the why, the Riverdale why, is actually meeting the people needs where they're at. I imagine when they come into your environment, many of the Jewish families feel that it's a very Jewish environment. And for many of the non-Jewish families, they're saying this is just a very good educational system which has very solid values behind it. And those two things don't conflict. Whereas for many of our listeners, there might be some juxtaposition here which doesn't make much sense. But is that a reflection that you think about?
100%. I spoke before about our schools need to reflect our community and our community needs. Here in Riverdale, we live in a very diverse community with a high Jewish population, and our school needs to reflect that. And by doing this, we live side by side in a place where our neighbors understand us and join us in our culture. It's funny, we use Friday afternoon Shabbat Shalom as a barometer of how we're doing. So when you see everybody leave on Friday, regardless of their background or origin, everybody says Shabbat Shalom to each other and carries challah out of school. And I always say, like, Shabbat Shalom doesn't have to have this religious connotation. And who can't enjoy a loaf of challah and some grape juice? And for us, I always think about how good are we doing by how long does it take people at the beginning of the school year to say Shabbat Shalom. And yeah, we use that.
I love it. The Shabbat Shalom barometer. I think we can all use that in our lives as well. So Francie, coming back to the question about your work or your area of work being in the news, and I was unclear whether I was going to go down this path, but I really do want to ask the question because it's been on my mind for a while, and that I saw recently in the news when one state in the country banned certain books from being available to students in their schools. Another group of libraries in a totally separate section of the country said, we're now going to open our library up for free, basically, to any student around the world, specifically if they want to access these so-called banned books. So I know a bit of your biography has dealt with these issues before. So partly tell us about your origin story in this regard, and tell us about banned books as well.
So freedom to read is a mantra most to all librarians really believe and want to express. We believe that the library is a place for self-discovery, for you to find the resources that you are interested in learning and exploring, and nobody has the right to tell you that is bad. So when banned books are in the news, those who take to heart that freedom to read, they are the first to showcase and get all over this. I'm giving you what other people are saying no to. So in my personal day-to-day at Hank Plainview, I don't have a banned book problem, but I definitely foster a love of exploration. And if a child is interested in something, I will sooner shoot that mother an email. I know you only have a kid in kindergarten, but he really wants to learn about mamba snakes. Can I send him home the book? And 99.8% of the time, the parents are always happy to accommodate their child's interest, which is really good for me.
And tell us about your prior job and some of the other issues you were dealing with in relation to these issues of access to books and access to reading. So I think that's very interesting that that trajectory brought you to where you are today as well.
So before I worked in Hank Plainview, I was in the public library in Pamunak, which is a subsidized housing unit area in Queens. And a lot of the children who came into my children's room were not even latchkey kids. Their parents went to work and took the PM shift. And they were with me from the minute school ended until the library closed. And we would have to figure out what they were interested in. We would create events based on their needs. So their needs were homework help. Sometimes we had to make sure they had dinner. We had to make sure that we were going to cater to whatever they wanted. If they wanted to learn how to use the computer, we would create a program for that. If the teenagers wanted to create resumes, that's how our event programming calendar evolved. It was, what do you want? Because you're here every day for 7 hours. And that really gave me the foundation to explore all kinds of programming on a lot of different levels for different age groups of children.
One of the things I really liked hearing when I'm talking to you, Francie, here is that the path to becoming a Jewish educator is not always linear. In fact, many of the educators that I know have gone through these paths, often involving themselves in the non-Jewish community in education and then coming back or returning to Jewish education as part of what they do. But I think sometimes we don't play up enough the value of having experiences outside the Jewish world and what it means we can bring talent like yourself into the Jewish community with those other experiences. So is there anything you're able to identify about your prior experiences which you might not have expected to have become so valuable in your work at Hank?
I think I have a lot more empathy and a lot more patience because of that experience in the public library. I am such a cookie cutter human. I went to Yeshiva Day School. I went to MMY my year in Israel. I went to Stern College. I went to Queens College for my master's. I was the quintessential bubble human. So to be thrown into a job where everybody around me were people I've never experienced created a whole different human in me to say, I cannot even believe that people I read books about, people I see on the news are now children and adults I interact with daily. So coming back to a Jewish education, I have a whole new sense of, well, we need to add empathy programming and we need to create sock drives for people who are in unfortunate situations because I've seen these other people and their needs and I see what happens when they're given stuff to succeed. And that is a core Jewish value that we need to start in elementary school.
So I know our listeners can't see this, but I can see right now as we're recording, Emily nodding her head. So I'm wondering, Emily, if you have any responses here or reactions to what Francie's saying.
No, I am a little bit of the opposite of Francie. I always thought I went to the American Jewish University. I went to Nishmat. I always thought I was going to spend my life in Jewish day schools. And here I realize how big the work is. I'm essentially in some way a public school administrator. I deal with the New York City Department of Education. I have a more diverse population than I would ever dream of. And something that rolls around in my head every day is how do I be Jewish and stay true to my Jewish values and the Jewish education I set out to teach in this world in such a diverse setting? And it's, again, so big, so much more and so different than what I thought I would do in this world.
Do either of you know like what your future holds for you in Jewish education? If I was to ask you, like, what's your dream job in a few years' time? Like, are you able to articulate what that could or might be? Emily, you want to try this one?
So we're at this precipice, this like very exciting moment of early childhood education, where if all the stars align and the right advocates are heard, then universal early childhood education will go national. And the Jewish community has this moment that we can't lose and we can't mess it up. David, you know better than I do. I think it's 90% of Jewish kids do not go to Jewish day school. And if they're given a choice between Jewish education you pay for and quality education that's not Jewish but free, they're going to pick free 90% of the time. And we cannot miss this opportunity to engage with every member of the Jewish community and their family at this level.
I just want to, before I come into France here, I want to really just double down on this point that we are at a moment in time, and the pandemic showed perhaps more than ever before in society the value that early childhood education has, not just in education itself, but actually in maintaining the infrastructure of a society to function. And I think that can't be lost in this conversation as well. Emily?
And that's my dream. As you talk about like our dream job or in 3 years from now, 5 years from now, my dream and my hope is to bring the nation with me to see we are doing Jewish education in this way. I'm going to show you how. We're going to construct it together. Come with me. Let's do it.
Francie, where do you see yourself?
Emily, you are a really impressive person. I just want to say. I really want to be somebody who other Jewish day school educators come to and say, I want to make a really impressive program. I want to learn how to partner with the other local community opportunities. And you ran an amazing program. You created allergy awareness on your campus in a completely different way than I've ever seen before. And I would really love to be kind of like these Jewish Education Project micro grant people I speak to all the time. Like, I want to be somebody who says, let me be your cheerleader. Let me guide you. Let me tell you how to make this program work for you and your campus and your kids, and just help create really, really good humans from the youngest age.
So I just want to mention at this point that I'm extremely proud that the Jewish Education Project has a Young Pioneer Award, which recognizes innovative educators in the New York area of a certain age. I'm extremely, extremely honored and privileged and humbled that we named them after my predecessor, Robert M. Sherman, because I think he exemplified the desire to invest in these young people. But there's a touch of ambivalence here. When we refer to people as Young Pioneer Award winners, I don't want to belittle the actual capacity for people of all ages to impact the sectors in which we're all acting in Jewish education. And I think this conversation with Emily and Francie really shows that just because they might be of a certain age does not mean in any way that we are diminishing their actual contribution to the entire sector of Jewish education. And you're both incredibly, incredibly inspiring. As part of your journey, both of you received from the Jewish Education Project micro grants. And I'll be honest here, when we first thought about giving micro grants to people in the field of Jewish education, I was a bit agnostic in terms of, this is a relatively small amount of money. How's it going to actually contribute to the ongoing support and development of educators? And lo and behold, like years and years down the track, we see over and over again that micro grants of relatively small amounts of money have made significant contributions to people's educational experiences. So as both of you have been recipients of these grants in the past, I'd love to hear about what impact they had on you and on the work that you're doing. So, Francie, tell us about the micro grants and how they've impacted you.
A little money goes a long way. You should just know. So I've won the grant twice. I won a grant for a mindfulness program and bringing psychologists to the school back in 2019. The school year was 2019-2020. So it ended up being a key component of helping navigate our parents and our students through the pandemic, because we were able to have a virtual town hall with these psychologists, both just with the students, just with the parents, to help them get through real unprecedented times. And we were able to incorporate mindfulness into daily life at school, which we still continue with today. And the second micro grant I won was to run an allergy awareness program on our campus, which has been going on throughout the school year. In the beginning of the year, we had our local ShopRite owner come. We recreated ShopRite in our media lab, and kids went shopping and had to read labels and had to spot if it had allergens, and then they knew they couldn't have it. Every child got a teddy bear. Every teddy bear had an allergy. They had to keep a food log to feed their bear and keep it alive. We also had a pediatric allergist come. These were all networking and partnering through. We really had to pivot a lot because of COVID. Some places we were supposed to go to ShopRite. ShopRite had to come to Hank Plainview. But people who, I really call them micro grant cheerleaders. I mean, they were there every step of the way to say, how's it going? Those check-ins, they pushed me to think out of the box. They gave me ideas to think about. And I've always done and asked the kids afterwards, if you created the program, what would you have done differently? And now here in May, in National Allergy Month, the children are making lunch menus using our caterer's menu that the lunch committee picks from. This week, that's what the students were doing. They were making their own menus, mixing and matching. And then hopefully their choices will end up on the school lunch menu next year. So they are really taking to heart what it means to cross out that string beans with almonds option because it's a nut-free school, and thinking out of the box and with empathy towards their classmates and the other kids in the school, and become sensitive in and out of the school to allergies. And I'm really honored to work with the Jewish Education Project to get this out of the box type of program into my school, and would love to give recognition to other schools that they too can do something like this.
Emily, how have the micro grants affected or impacted you?
I want to echo Francie that a little money goes a long way in early childhood. Grants are hard to come by. And when we got ours, I was like, it's so exciting. I can do everything I want and more. So we opened a loose parts studio for families. We saw kind of two hurdles we were looking to overcome. The school starts at 9, and a lot of families were dropping off at a school down the street at 8:10, and then they were coming up the hill to us, and people were sitting around with their grown-ups, and I wanted an opportunity for them to engage and to build community. The other hurdle we were looking to kind of overcome was we are a little limited, as you heard me say before, about how we celebrate holidays in our classrooms. So we opened this Chagim, a holiday loose parts studio in our lobby, where for every upcoming holiday, a few weeks before and about a week after, we put out all kinds of creative loose part materials that are meant to be temporary for kids to engage with. And then we offer different prompts. We'll put out the libraries that have to do with the holidays. I will post. I believe in engaging grownups also in learning. So there will be traditional Jewish texts about where the holiday is found, or something about the holiday or themes about the holiday, and maybe some pictures. So right now we have Lag BaOmer out there. So we have all kinds of wood pieces and red fluffy pipe cleaners and feathers and orange and yellow beads to do with the fire. And it's a way that people can engage together with their grownups around the holiday before the school day ever starts.
I mean, I just love hearing both of you say, yes, that a little bit of money goes a long way. And here I should clearly thank UJA Federation of New York, who grants money to the Jewish Education Project to make all of this possible. And I hear the piece about the money. What I'm even more excited about is that it seems like the grant was able to open up boxes and innovative thinking and creative ways of doing things. And sometimes people think, yeah, we just go about our jobs. But sometimes when something relatively small is put in front of you, all of a sudden you're unleashed to think differently about things as well. And I guess that's really exciting for me to hear. So thanks to both of you as well. I'd love to hear, as we begin to wrap today's session up with both of you, about what impact you think receiving the Young Pioneer Award is having on you, or might have on you, and how do you think about the receiving of this award? Francie.
Well, I am really honored to receive this award. I am usually somebody who creates the program, implements the program, lets someone else take the credit. I'm in almost no photos of these programs that I've created because I'm such a behind the scenes. I just want people to have this experience, you know, whether it's a recruiting program or a school program for the kids. So I'm so excited to be recognized for this. And also, I love that the Jewish Education Project highlights that people could and should go above and beyond. I mean, you can easily just box check school programming. You know, Lag BaOmer is coming. You made a bonfire out of, you know, pipe cleaners and wood, and that's great. And now the kids understand it. But a push to have outside of the box thinking to celebrate that, and innovative thinkers to be celebrated, is something that I find amazing and very much appreciate.
Emily, the impact on you?
I'm so excited and so thankful to the Jewish Education Project. Jewish education is so exciting, but early childhood Jewish education is often the last people think of. Like, we're little people, we're tiny humans that don't often get thought about much. To be held up in this field and say what this sect of Jewish education is doing is just as important as what's going on in yeshiva day schools or in supplementary schools or in camps is super exciting. And it really means a lot, not just to me and my school, but the entire field of Jewish early childhood.
So finally, I'd like to ask you a question that I've asked almost all of my previous guests on adapting. Who is an educator in your life who you want to pay tribute to, someone who's made an impression or a difference to you as an educator? Emily.
So when I first left graduate school, we moved from sunny LA to a very cold Minnesota. And there I met an educator, Robert Portnow, who at the time was the Judaic studies principal at the community day school there. That's what he was on paper. But in reality, he was the most natural educator of Torah I've ever met. To this day, every week I see him over Zoom learn with my young daughter. I see him learn with my husband. I see him learn with all these other people who his students just like are scattered throughout the day. And he is adapting Torah and differentiating it and approaching every person in the way that they need it to be. I have never seen anyone live the lens of Drash and really capture the tradition that Torah has 70 faces. And he really, throughout knowing him, has inspired me to not only bring Torah to our youngest community members, but also to continue to dedicate myself to like deep Torah study, no matter where I'm holding in life.
Francie, pay tribute to someone in your life.
So my fifth grade English teacher, Karen Stetelnik, was the first teacher I ever had who brought out of the box thinking to the classroom. On Mets opening day, we all had to wear Mets gear and, you know, get excited about them. And she was the one who would create these extra programs for the entire school. For us, she would call them mini-mester. And they were things like the invention convention, or we would learn about people with disabilities. And she was the driving force behind those programs when I was a child. So when I ended up back in Jewish education, also that was in Henk West Hempstead. And now I'm working in Henk Plainview. So I actually overlapped. She was still teaching in West Hempstead, Henk, when I started in Plainview. So I reconnected with her and said, I want to bring back Mini-Mester. And all of these thoughts that I had were flooding back to the person who created them on the other campus, the sister campus of my school. And she recently came at this year's author visit. I invited her special because she's newly retired, and she came to surprise the author, who it was a really awesome day. And I still look to her as a role model in education, next generation level, next level programming. She was the one who really showed me you could do this in a Jewish day school.
So clearly the audience can't see me now, but I haven't stopped smiling throughout today's conversation. Talking with Francie and Emily has been truly refreshing and inspiring, and I hope you as an audience have also taken many great nuggets of information, not just about them and the work they're doing, but about the impact that they are having on the field today. And sure as I can be, keep your eye on these two rising stars, because they're going to continue to have tremendous impact in the Jewish community and on Jewish education for many, many years to come. It's our absolute honor to be able to give them, reward them, or award them as recipients of the Robert M. Sherman Young Pioneers Award. If you go to our website at jewishedproject.org, you can see a video about this year's group of awardees, including some of their bios and maybe even how to contact them. And next week, I'll be speaking with the other three recipients of this year's awards as well, Amram Atzman, Jessica Cohen, and Megan Sass. So really, I hope you can all join with me in thanking Francie and Emily for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was a pleasure to join you.
Today's episode was produced by Dina Nussenbaum and Gabriel Weinstein. The show's executive producers are myself, Karen Cummins, and Nessa Lieben. And our show, as always, is engineered and edited by Nathan J. Vaughan of NJV Media. If you enjoyed today's adapting session as much as I did, I urge you to give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, and even better still, share it with a friend, because we really want to get the voices of our Young Pioneer Award winners and all of our other guests out to as many people as possible. To learn more about the Jewish Education Project, visit jewishedproject.org. There you can learn more about our history, our mission, and the staff who work with me on a daily basis. And as has been made evident today, especially as recipients of microgrants and the Young Pioneer Award winners, we are always grateful to our partners at UJA Federation of New York, who contribute to our organization and make it all possible. Thanks everybody for listening today.